about freedom, prosperity, and peace.
Can you hear it? Can you hear that message of freedom? Can you feel it? That message of freedom is spreading across America. Thousands and thousands of people are hearing it.
Join us in this great campaign for freedom and liberty. Thank you very much.
And they're coming to it. Drawn to it. You're listening to The Freedom Message with Stephen Vincent live on BBSRadio.com. The number to call into the show and participate is 877-270-8714, 877-270-8714, 877-270-8714. I would love to take your call, talk a little Ron Paul, talk about what's going on in the world, and talk about how we're going to get this man elected president and save our country from absolute, total, complete disaster and despotism. That's no exaggeration, by the way. You don't believe me? Then sit around and do nothing. Watch, wait, and see just what happens if we fail to get Ron Paul elected president. If we fail to generate a significant movement for his message, for the freedom message in this country, something that will stand between us and tyranny and destruction. So go ahead. Do nothing. See what happens. I don't encourage you to do nothing. I encourage you to do absolutely everything that you possibly can. This is our time. It has arrived. This is the moment, this is the time for all men and women of conscience, for all patriots, for all who care about what is right and good in this world to stand up on both feet and take a step forward for peace, for freedom, for the Constitution, for the rule of law, and for the one man who can help us through these times, Congressman Dr. Ron Paul. So I'd like to refer you to my website, www.ronpaulfreedommessage.com, ronpaulfreedommessage.com. And I'd like you to go there right now, and there is now a player on the page, and you will be able to see the video clips that I am playing. Now, as a radio show, you can listen to them, of course, if you don't want to watch. But beginning tomorrow, you will be able to see all the video clips that I play. And you'll also be able to see me, too, speaking to you live on the air. And what I'm going to do right now, I only have one clip that I'm going to play for you today that you'll be able to actually see on the show. But if you go to www.ronpaulfreedommessage right now, I am going to go ahead and play for you a MSNBC interview with Ron Paul. Now, just to set this up for you a little bit, this is the interview in which Nora O'Donnell almost apologizes for calling Ron Paul an isolationist. We all remember that precious moment when Ron Paul's numbers came in at $5.1 million raised in the third quarter. And Nora O'Donnell was handed the script, and she was told, when she got the news that Ron Paul had raised $5.1 million, she just stuttered and stammered and searched for something to detract from the news of Ron Paul raising $5.1 million, and she labeled him an isolationist several times. It was the one thing that she could come up with off the top of her head. This isolationist has raised $5.1 million. I mean, she was almost in a panic. Almost in a panic. Well, it seems as though she's done a bit of backtracking here. So I'm going to go ahead and play this for you right now.
It's money we don't even have. We have to borrow it or we have to print it. It's a devastating number. It's going to bring us to our knees. It's going to lead to a financial crisis. And we can't achieve anything of real value by just expanding that war over there. We're not doing well there. And of course, my position is save the money and bring our troops home.
If you were president, how quickly would you bring the troops home?
As quickly as possible. I mean, you can't do it in a day or a week, but you talk to the military people and find out. But you change the policy. You say that we are not going to occupy Iraq, and we start closing down those bases, and within months, bring them home.
Congressman, you are 72 years old, and you are a sensation among young people in America who have helped fuel this large campaign war chest you have. They are very able on the Internet. When I have mentioned and said things about you in the past, my email box gets flooded.
Great.
When we reported that you raised $5 million on the Internet, I said that you were an isolationist. Describe what your position is.
Yeah, that's the wrong word. I'm sure you meant no harm, but an isolationist is a protectionist and doesn't want people to travel nor trade. I'm a free trader, and I want people to be able to travel. I just want our troops at home. I want to follow the founding fathers' advice about non-entangling alliances. Even George Bush's campaign in the year 2000 said, no entangling alliance, a humble foreign policy, no nation building. This is the traditional American policy. All the presidential candidates, even when they plan war, argued this case, but everybody knows I'm serious about it, and we should follow the Constitution, the advice of the founders, and what the Republican Party used to stand for.
Congressman, we talked about your very full campaign war chest, and yet there's a new LA Times Bloomberg poll out today which shows Rudy Giuliani getting 32% among likely Republican primary voters, Fred Thompson coming in second at 15%, followed by John McCain, Mitt Romney, and Mike Huckabee. You only registered at 2%. How do you explain, or how do you attribute to the fact that you're not doing so well into the polls?
Well, I think there is a discrepancy. It may be the way they do the polling. It may be that we have to spend the money that we have raised, but we certainly have the support. Our campaign is growing exponentially, fundraising, as well as the number of volunteers, and we have a presence around the country, and it's going to continue to grow. But we do have to prove ourselves. But those polls aren't the final word. There's a lot of people. Most most people are still pretty undecided, and it's early, but soon it'll come that time when we have these primaries, and I believe we'll prove ourselves just as we have proven ourselves in the fundraising.
Congressman, as you know, most of the other Republicans running for president that you've stood on stage with during the debate, they support a continuation of the war in Iraq. You want to end the war in Iraq. If one of them is awarded the Republican nomination, will you choose a third party? Will you not back that nominee?
No, I don't plan to run in a third party. That's not my goal. But if we have a candidate that loves the war and loves the neocon position of promoting...
Who is that? Who do you mean when you say someone who loves the war and loves neocon?
Well, the people who've run our foreign policy, all the advisors that the president has had, but they advise the Democrats as well. I mean, those who say that we can't take anything off the table as far as Iran is concerned, those who say we can't get our troops home, and this is on the Democratic side as well, for 2013, I mean, they are in control. The people who believe in interventionism and an aggressive foreign policy are in control of both parties. That's why I'm getting a lot of attention, and this is why we are able to raise the money, and this is also reflecting the fact that 70% of the American people are tired of this war, and as you pointed out, we don't even have the money to finance this war. We are going to go bankrupt, and the dollar is reflecting this. This is why the dollar is going down, because all great nations end because they get an empire that's too big and they can't afford it, and they eventually ruin their currency.
All right, Congressman, thanks so much for your time. Will you tell
Thank
your
you.
Supporters not to flood my email box?
Oh, no, I think you should enjoy reading them all.
Thanks for your time.
Thank you.
Okay, so there you have Congressman Ron Paul speaking with Nora O'Donnell yesterday, and I thought it was quite a special moment there at the end when Nora O'Donnell admits that she was certainly bombarded with emails from you, from Ron Paul supporters, and that this obviously affected her approach to Dr. Paul this time around. So what does that tell us? It tells us what we're doing works. Keep it up, guys. Everything that we're doing is working. So you want to keep on sending those emails whenever Dr. Paul is mistreated, whenever there are misstatements, whenever there are assumptions made about his position which are erroneous. Very good work. It obviously paid off this time around. Nora O'Donnell almost apologizing for treating Ron Paul the way she did the last time she announced that he had pulled in $5.1 million in the third quarter. So I also want to comment on the fact that I don't believe that I have seen a single interview where Dr. Paul is not asked whether he will run as a third party on a third party ticket. Why do they continually ask that over and over and over again? Did a memo go out? Well, it seems like most likely a memo went out from somewhere that he must be asked this in absolutely every interview. Why? Because we want to establish that he is on the outside of the Republican Party, that he will not win the Republican nomination, and that the implication is in the question. So aren't you going to run on a third party ticket, Dr. Paul? The implication being, of course, that you will not win the Republican nomination. Will you back the Republican nominee? Also, consistently asked every interview, every debate, and the answer that he gives is no, that he will not, unless the positions of the Republican Party and the Republican nominee change. He will not change back the nominee. And these questions are, again, asked to place him outside of the mainstream of the Republican Party. So there is a tactic, there is a reason behind the way they approach Dr. Paul in these interviews. Why is he also, every single interview, asked about the poll numbers? Every single time. You know, when there's good news, when there's bad news, whatever, they bring up the polls to basically, again, marginalize him. So I think he's handling these questions well, but I think it's really tiresome that the same questions are asked over and over and over and over again. Now, the question of calling Dr. Paul and his policy on foreign policy isolationist came up again. And well, it did. He did have an opportunity to really state his actual position. And in fact, he wrote in his weekly Texas Straight Talk column a piece about that very subject. So given that that's a topic that we've touched on already, I would like to go ahead and read that for you from Ron Paul's Texas Straight Talk weekly column. Interventionism, isolationism, actually, both. Okay, I'll tell you this, I haven't actually read this yet, so I'm going to be reading it for the first time together with you. A few months back, I wrote back-to-back weekly messages regarding globalism and isolationism. In writing those columns, I focused on the fact that our nation's interventionist foreign policy was precisely what was isolating us from other countries. Turkey's recall of their U.S. ambassador in the wake of last week's resolution passed in the House Foreign Affairs Committee in condemnation of Turkey is a perfect example of what I wrote in those columns, as well as what I have been saying for years. The House has passed similar resolutions for years, praising some foreign countries or political groups, while chastising others. It is my policy to vote against resolutions of this sort whenever they have the impact of placing our country in the middle of an internal political problem of some other nation, or involving us in some regional conflict. In fact, this is almost always the specific intent of resolutions of this sort. Often, I am the only member of Congress to vote against these resolutions. Some have questioned these votes, arguing that they are meaningless statements of opinion. However, I have always been more skeptical and careful about voting for these measures. Last week's reaction by Turkey, a long-term ally and NATO member, shows that Congress should be a lot more restrained in sticking our government's nose into the affairs of other nations. Even though I am no fan of the war in Iraq, keeping positive relations with Turkey is important to protecting our troops who have been sent to fight this war. We are likely to need cordial relations with Turkey so that we can get our troops out of Iraq as quickly and safely as possible when the time comes. As a member of the Foreign Affairs Committee, my office has been contacted by both the White House and the Turkish Embassy. They know I oppose these types of interventionist resolutions, and they know I will not support the current resolution. They also know full well that this particular resolution will only serve to strain an important international relationship our country should be seeking to strengthen. In this instance, the problem is that many of my colleagues in Congress are more interested in seeking to score political points and proclaim their moral superiority instead of worrying about our nation's best interests. Also, in most of these situations, those who oppose the resolution regarding Turkey all too often fail to realize that similar resolutions dealing with other nations have the exact same effect. Namely, they isolate our country from the rest of the world. Even if other countries do not take the rather extreme step of recalling their ambassador, this kind of meddling by congressional resolution almost always serves to offend governments and political leaders in other countries. Last week's events make clear that Congress and our foreign policy establishment must reconsider the entire policy of interventionism if we are to avoid further isolation of our nation. So I think that by example he's demonstrating the difference between interventionism and isolationism. In fact, interventionism leads to isolationism. The more that you intervene and meddle in other people's affairs, the more isolated you're going to become over time, with this recent incident with Turkey being a perfect current example of that in action. Now, we also had on the show last week Mr. David Brody, who is a correspondent for the Christian Broadcasting Network and has on the internet a page called The Brody Files. And we had an excellent interview with him at that time. He has been open-minded and somewhat positive in his attitude towards Dr. Paul. And and has been, basically open-minded. You know, we can't say that he's supportive of Dr. Paul because that would be inaccurate. But he does not tend to ask questions that are entirely loaded with bias. He does not write articles that are entirely loaded with bias. They tend to be open-minded and observational, openly observational of what is happening with the Ron Paul revolution, the Ron Paul movement. So I'm going to play a series of five clips from a recent interview by David Brody, just a few days after my interview with David Brody. And I'll start with this one in which Mr. Brody asks Congressman Paul about the Ron Paul revolution.
Let me ask you first about the Ron Paul revolution. You've heard the term, no doubt. Tell me a little bit about what you've experienced out there.
Well, it's something a group, I believe it was in Arizona, coined it, and they started making signs, and of course they spell L-O-V-E backwards in part of the revolution, and it has spread. It's all around the country. No matter where I go, I'll see signs like that. I saw a sign just coming in here, Ron Paul Revolution. And they love it, and to me, it means that they want to see some real changes in this country. But they liked our old revolution, you know, when we overthrew the king and all the regulations and big government and spending and the military operations of the king. You know, they want to overthrow that. So they call this a continuation of that revolution. And I think it's rather neat. But it might mean different things to different people. You know, I guess it all depends on whom you ask.
What does it mean to you?
I think it means that we want change in this country, big changes, that they're they'd like to see this country turned around where the people have control of their lives and control of their money and control of their destiny. And today they feel helpless. They feel like the government's running roughshod over them. They confiscate too much wealth through taxation. They make a lot of promises and they never fulfill them. And I think they want to be free again. I think we have less freedom now than we used to have, and certainly not what was envisioned by our founders.
So, a nice open-ended question about the Ron Paul Revolution. I wanted to add that when we ended our interview with David Brody, he was mentioning that he was going to do a piece for CNBC that would include an interview with Dr. Paul and would be about the Ron Paul mania. And I said to him, you know, David, I'd just like to ask you a favor. I wonder if you could find another word that you could use instead of mania, because we are consistently struggling with this attitude towards the Ron Paul movement that we're a bunch of, you know, crazies, you know. And he heard that. He heard that. And I told him, you know, I think that if you check into it, you're going to see that Ron Paul supporters are, in fact, among the most intelligent and thoughtful and really the best of America. And, you know, he really heard that. And then I sent him a follow-up email, and I said, you know, one term you might consider using is the Ron Paul Revolution, because it's come into somewhat accepted. We accept it. We feel comfortable with it. Okay. And you know, we feel comfortable with it, and it appears that Dr. Paul has over time come comfortable with the term Ron Paul Revolution. So why don't we go with that? And then here we see he did choose the term Ron Paul Revolution. So another example that we can have an effect. Just another example of that very same principle. I think we have a caller on the line. Is Kathy there? Hello. Hi. Do we have the caller on the line?
Hello?
Hi, how you doing?
Hello?
Hi, you're on the air.
Hello?
You're on the air.
Hello?
Okay, it seems like we're having some kind of technical problem. Are you there? Hello?
Hello?
Okay, I guess it's not working. We'll try this another time. Okay, maybe we can see what the problem is, why Kathy can't hear me. I can hear her. So I'm going to go on to the next clip. Now, I have, let's see, this is a question about, is Ron Paul on the fringe? So we brought up that issue of you know, are we you know, are we the crazies, you know? And here's a question about, you know, is Ron Paul a fringe candidate?
There is a perception out there, I'm not saying reality, but there's a perception that you're tapping into the libertarian crowd that is very loud, that some people have called eccentric, that some people think that may be on the fringe, so to speak. How do you address that, and how can you change that reputation exactly?
Well, I think the facts will change that reputation, because you take the group of individuals that donate more money to me than any other candidate, Republican or Democrat, are military people. So that's hardly fringe. I mean, if you're going to call the people who support me on the fringe, why is it that I take a different position on foreign policy, since I take the founding fathers' position and the Republican position of non-entangling alliances, you know, and less intervention, and yet the military loves it? So I would say this is hardly a a fringe position, and I think libertarianism is fine. Libertarianism just means you believe in liberty, and everybody believes in liberty. And the founders were great believers in libertarianism. But if you talk about an organized libertarian group, I mean, if it were that strong, why wouldn't they have been doing a lot better as a libertarian party? So I don't think I don't think it can be written off so easily, especially when you go to the college campuses. I was on the University of Michigan the other day, and we had 2,000 people show up, and probably 20 of them might have known about the Libertarian Party and the Libertarian message, but they knew about what I was talking about, and that is more freedom for themselves and more responsibility for themselves.
Do you think the Republican establishment and some of these candidates and their campaigns blow you off? Just blow you off, think you're not legitimate?
Less so every day. They used to try to, but they know we can't. We're not going to go away. And our numbers are growing. I mean, our fundraising, most of the fundraising, the true donations have gone down in every other campaign on the Republican side. Mine doubled. And we expected it to double again, you know, in the next quarter. So, if they do, it's at their own risk, you know. If they say, we don't have to worry about him, but we'll see what happens.
What are you going to do with that money? Tell me a little bit about how you're going to go about in these next couple months and translate money into votes.
Well, we've started spending it. We've done some TV, and that'll be ready soon, and we've done some radio, and that has started. It's going to go into the early states, and we got to prove ourselves. You know, we'll have to decide whether it's a myth that we have this strong support, and where is this money coming from if it's just a bunch of people out there spamming? You know, are they spamming money too? No, we have to prove ourselves, and we have the money in the bank, more so than most of the other candidates.
With Romney, he talks a lot of, well, his other folks say that Romney, it's important that he does well in Iowa or New Hampshire, or both, really. With Giuliani, it's Florida, clearly. What about your campaign? Is there one state that you know it's a make or break? You've got to do well where? New Hampshire?
Well, I think all the early ones, but I wouldn't put it all on one, because I think
where's the breakthrough, though? Where do you think you have the best opportunity to break through?
Well, I would say New Hampshire is really lends itself toward a candidate like myself, and you know, the independents can go over. That's sort of how McCain did it last time. The independents went over and voted for the Republicans, but of course John's having a little bit of problem raising money and with his campaign now. So I think we have a good chance there. But it's not like saying if I'm not in first or second place in New Hampshire, it's all over. I mean, all I know is steady growth and steady persistence. Our campaign is growing. The money is coming in. As long as that works and there's a viable campaign, we'll continue.
And the Ron Paul revolution lives on.
It'll continue, regardless.
Okay, so, you got to like that. Congressman Paul is having a little bit of fun here. He's very confident. I like the confidence when he's asked, well, aren't the other Republicans just blowing you off? And, he's coming off with confidence there that, they do so at their own peril. Because we are making inroads and we are making progress and we have the money in the bank and more so than many of the other candidates and we're in pretty good shape. If you're noticing perhaps that Mr. Brody asks questions that are just questions. Legitimate questions that he's asking, but the questions are not loaded with implications. He's asking legitimate questions about the political situation. And that's fine. But he doesn't, front load his questions with all kinds of innuendo. And when he asks a question, he actually allows Congressman Paul to actually answer the question. And we're going to go ahead and play three more clips here. But I do want you to make it on the list of things to do to email Mr. Brody. Go to the Brody Files at CBN.com. ChristianBroadcastingNetwork.com, and find the Brody Files, and then email Mr. Brody and thank him for his fair and open questions and for actually allowing Congressman Paul to answer them. And I think we have our caller back. Let's see. Do we have Kathy on the line? Hello? Hello? Okay. Here's what happens, folks. If you're going to call the show, that's wonderful. Love to hear from you. But please be ready to go on the air when you call. Don't go away. Don't get distracted and do something else. All right? So we're going to go ahead and play another clip.
On the pro-life issue, on the life issue, your campaign nationally, and I'm talking about the narrative that's been painted by the media out there, they don't talk much about your position on the life issue. Explain why you think that might be, and maybe just more specifically, tell me a little bit about your stance regarding Roe v. Wade and wanting to be...
Yeah, well, I talk about it a lot. I'm a right-to-life person from way back, and I delivered 4,000 babies and written a book on abortion and the issue, both from a moral and a political viewpoint. And I think it's probably the most important, egregious ruling ever made was Roe versus Wade. And I have a method of reversing that with a simple majority vote in the Congress. And I'm always dumbfounded I don't get more support from the right-to-life community because they say, no, we want to amend the Constitution. Well, that's fine and dandy, but you can do it by majority vote, and that is just remove the jurisdiction. And I have a We the People's Act and a Sanctity of Life Act, which literally just takes the jurisdiction out. So if the state of Florida had a law that protected the unborn, it could not be heard in the federal court. All you need is a majority vote in the Senate and a signature of the president, which we should have had, you know, when we had the majority, and we didn't touch that approach. We said, no, we want to amend the Constitution. And I don't understand why the tactics have been such where we have rejected that approach. And this could come about so quickly, and it would further endorse the principle of federalism. States are supposed to deal with these problems, not the federal government. But Roe versus Wade needs repealed. It needs off the book. It's a horrible piece of legislation. They shouldn't have done it. Texas had a right to pass that law. And then the courts go and rule on it, and they write legislation writing details to what the physician can do in the first trimester, the second trimester, and the third trimester, and nothing has happened. We're not making very good progress. I have, on numerous times, introduced legislation, especially on foreign policy, that no funds will go to family planning. But our right-to-life people won't vote for that because they say all we want to do is have a prohibition of this family planning money not going to abortion. But all these funds are fungible, and I want to strike all that money. And they say, oh, no, that's too radical. You can't do that. But that's what should be done. We shouldn't have any money going to any organization domestically or internationally, and the money is still flowing, so taxpayers are still supporting abortion through their taxes.
Okay, so that was Dr. Paul on the pro-life issue, which is, of course, as far as the CBN audience, a key issue. Interesting that he took a somewhat different tact on that response. He usually goes to the states' rights argument on that, and here he's emphasizing a more legislative approach to the pro-life issue of securing the rights of the unborn. So let's go ahead and go to a clip regarding the war in Iraq. And again, here David Brody's going to ask some tough questions, but you're going to find that they're fair. And Dr. Paul does a great job of answering this question. It's something we should all listen to and learn how to answer likewise.
You're considered not an anti-war candidate, because you're not necessarily against all wars, but the anti-Iraq war for sure. How do you win the Republican nomination when polls suggest, like in New Hampshire, for example, where 80% of the GOP indeed do support the Iraq war, the effort there? How do you go about and try and win the nomination against that type of hurdle?
Well, it's a job, but if the Republicans want to win the election next year, they have to realize that 70-some percent of the American people want us out of Iraq. I mean, they're tired of the war. I mean, the whole sentiment has totally shifted. And you appeal to Republicans through Republican ideals. Don't go to war unless it's declared. If you declare war, win it and get it over with and come home. Don't go to war under UN resolutions. We can't afford wars that drag on because it costs too much. We have to borrow all our money from China right now to fight these wars. And the tradition of the Republican Party is we have generally benefited tremendously by taking a less military stance. You know, think about how Eisenhower won after the Democrats got us in Korea. Nixon won after the Democrats in the 60s got us in the Vietnam. How did Bush win in the year 2000? His campaign, including me, we condemned Clinton for Bosnia and Kosovo, for military intervention over there and nation building. We ran on a humble foreign policy. And the old tradition of Robert Taft was non-intervention. He didn't want to be in NATO. And even before World War I and World War II, our country was, until they were forced into the war, were vehemently opposed to it. And even those presidents that at the time were maneuvering us into war said, I will promise you, I will keep you out of war. It is so... We have benefited tremendously as Republicans by taking the position of being more cautious in getting into these conflicts. So I believe I represent the traditional Republican position on this.
Good. So I think that that's something that we can always come back to when we're asked about that, is that we represent the traditional Republican position, and that the neocon position is a new position. The neocon position of endless war, the neocon position of an enemy who will fight us until we are utterly destroyed, these positions are new to the Republican Party. Interventionist policies were, in fact, traditionally the policies of the Democrats. And George Bush campaigned on a non-interventionist foreign policy, on staying out of the affairs of other countries and no nation building. Well, he certainly changed that tune pretty quickly. And I think that was just the line that he was giving out in order to get into power and then turn around and do exactly what they wanted to do all along, which was to get us into a war in Iraq. Let's see. The next thing I want to go to is a clip about privacy and the Patriot Act. And again, he asks a tough question, but Dr. Paul handles it well, and I think it's something that we can learn from.
The Patriot Act, real quick. You're against it for the most part, or you are against it. Let me ask you exactly why, and maybe more specifically, as it relates to trying to win the GOP nomination. There are going to be your opponents that say you sound exactly like the other side, so to speak, the Democrats on this.
Well, I don't know. I don't think the Democrats are very good on it either. They, you know, Hillary and these others voted for the thing, you know, so, and they voted for the war, so they don't have very good positions either. I'm just a strong believer in the Constitution. I think it messes up the Fourth Amendment. I think it gives you access to our privacy. There may be 10 bad guys out there, and now we monitor billions and billions of transactions that's going on because we might find somebody. They have so much information on everybody now that it goes through the cracks. Matter of fact, they had a lot of information buried before 9/11 that would have been every bit, you know, very usable but we had too much information, and it was too bureaucratic, and they had a lot of evidence to indicate what was coming, but it wasn't so much that it was done deliberately, it was just inept. They had too much, but now we're getting even more at the sacrifice of our personal liberties, and I take the position that you do not have to sacrifice freedom for security. Too many Americans now believe that we have to give up so much of our security in order to be safe, give up our liberties in order to be safe, and I don't think it's necessary.
Well, something came across my desk just shortly before the air, and I haven't really had a chance to read it, but apparently a new bill has been introduced to Congress, H.R. 1955, and it's titled the Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act of 2007. The Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act of 2007. Now, just on a quick look, this would appear to be the Anti-American Freedom Agenda Act. It would appear to be the antithesis of the American Freedom Agenda Act. Instead of moving us back to the Constitution, to the protections that the Constitution gives us, this act apparently would further strip constitutional protections. And I'm going to just peruse this article here. And thanks to Charlie for sending it in. This bill is one of the most blatant attacks against the Constitution yet, and actually defines thought crimes as homegrown terrorism. If passed into law, it will also establish a commission and a center of excellence to study and defeat so-called thought criminals. Unlike previous anti-terror legislation, this bill specifically targets the civilian population of the United States and uses vague language to define homegrown terrorism. Let's take a look at the definitions of violent radicalization and homegrown terrorism as defined in Section 899A of the bill. The definition of violent radicalization uses vague language to define this term of promoting any belief system that the government considers to be an extremist agenda. Since the bill doesn't specifically define what an extremist belief system is, it is entirely up to the interpretation of the government. Considering how much the government has done to destroy the Constitution, they could even define Ron Paul supporters as promoting an extremist belief system. Literally, the government, according to this definition, can define whatever they want as an extremist belief system. Essentially, they have defined violent radicalization as thought crime. The definition as defined in the bill is shown below. Violent radicalization. The term violent radicalization means the process of adopting or promoting an extremist belief system for the purpose of facilitating ideologically based violence to advance political, religious, or social change. Okay, let me read that again. The term violent radicalization means the process of adopting or promoting an extremist belief system for the purpose of facilitating ideologically based violence to advance political, religious, or social change. Well, that does seem pretty vague. Now, first of all, it's always been the held belief with regards to the constitutionality of speech that you can have any opinion you want. You can believe that the entire United States of the United States ought to be blown up with nuclear weapons tomorrow. You can believe it. You can go on a preach on a street corner and get up on a soapbox and preach it and try to convince everybody else that you are right and that all the United States ought to be blown up with nuclear bombs tomorrow, and that we all ought to dedicate ourselves to doing this. You could have that belief constitutionally. Now, you can have the belief, but you just can't go ahead and do it. As soon as you try to actually do it, then obviously you're committing treason and you should be arrested, thrown in jail, and tried. constitutionally, of course, you know, with due process of law, of course, but you can hold the opinion. Now, here we're saying that you cannot hold this opinion, that you cannot hold a violent radicalization view, adopting or promoting an extremist belief system. No, it does not define what is an extremist belief system. For the purpose of facilitating ideologically based violence. What does facilitating mean? That seems like that could be variously interpreted. When is something violent? When is it violent? When does it become violence? That could be interpreted. To advance political, religious, or social change. Very interesting. The definition of homegrown terrorism uses equally vague language to further define thought crime. So I think that the author of this piece is pretty much, from what I'm gathering so far, accurate in their categorization of this bill as a bill to establish thought crime. That you cannot think or hold certain beliefs. If you do, you are committing a crime. The bill includes the planned use of force or violence as homegrown terrorism, which could be interpreted as thinking about using force or violence. Not only that, but the definition is so vaguely defined that petty crimes could even fall into the category of homegrown terrorism. The definition as defined in the bill is shown below. It reminds me of the time when someone that I knew, I wouldn't call him a friend, but someone that I knew was arrested by the police for making terrorist threats because he said something to somebody that, you know, implied that he would kick their ass or something to that extent, and he was arrested for making terrorist threats. The definition as defined in the bill is shown below, homegrown terrorism. The term homegrown terrorism means the use, planned use, or threatened use of force or violence by a group or individual born, raised, or based and operating primarily within the United States or any possession of the United States to intimidate or coerce the United States government, the civilian population of the United States, or any segment thereof in furtherance of political or social objectives. The use, planned use, or threatened use of force or violence. So in other words, that's pretty clear. If you threaten to use verbally or hold the opinion that violence ought to be used, then you fall under the category of homegrown terrorist. Section 899B of the bill goes over the findings of Congress as it pertains to homegrown terrorism. Particularly alarming is that the bill mentions the internet as a main source for terrorist propaganda. The bill even mentions streams in obvious reference to many of the Patriot and pro-Constitution internet radio networks that have been formed. It also mentions that homegrown terrorists span all ages and races, indicating that the Congress is stating that everyone is a potential terrorist. Even worse is that Congress states in their findings that they should look at draconian police states like Canada, Australia, and the United Kingdom as models to defeat homegrown terrorists. Literally, these findings of Congress fall right in line with the growing patriot community. It says here the U.S. House of Representatives recently passed H.R. 1955. I'm not sure if it's actually been passed. I mean, I can't believe that I haven't heard of this. It was already in Congress and they just passed it. That's absolutely phenomenal. Perhaps it's only just been introduced. I'm really hoping and praying that this piece of anti-constitutional garbage has merely been introduced to Congress and not actually passed by it yet. When a piece of a diamond like Dr. Paul's legislation isn't even out of committee yet. The biggest joke of all is that this section also says that any measure to prevent violent radicalization and homegrown terrorism should not violate the constitutional rights of citizens. However, the definition of violent radicalization and homegrown terrorism, as they are defined in Section 899A, are themselves unconstitutional. The Constitution does not allow the government to arrest people for thought crimes, so any promise to not violate the constitutional rights of citizens are already broken by their own definitions. So here's the findings upon which this abomination is based. The Congress finds the following. 1. The development and implementation of methods and processes that can be utilized to prevent violent radicalization, homegrown terrorism, and ideologically based violence in the United States is critical to combating domestic terrorism. 2. The promotion of violent radicalization, homegrown terrorism, and ideologically based violence exists in the United States and poses a threat to homeland security. Oh my God. 3. The internet has aided in facilitating violent radicalization, ideologically based violence, and the homegrown terrorism process in the United States by providing access to broad and constant streams of terrorist-related propaganda to United States citizens. 4. While the United States must continue its vigilant efforts to combat international terrorism, it must also strengthen efforts to combat the threat posed by homegrown terrorists based and operating within the United States. 5. Understanding the motivational factors that lead to violent radicalization, homegrown terrorism, and ideologically based violence is a vital step towards eradicating these threats in the United States. 6. The potential rise of self-radicalization to unaffiliated terrorists domestically cannot be easily prevented through traditional federal intelligence or law enforcement efforts and requires the incorporation of state and local solutions, in other words, the further federalization of state and local police. 7. Individuals prone to violent radicalization, homegrown terrorism, and ideologically based violence span all races, ethnicities, and religious beliefs, and individuals should not be targeted solely based on race, ethnicity, or religion. In other words, everybody should be targeted equally. Thank you, that's so considerate of you. Any measure taken to prevent violent radicalization, homegrown terrorism, and ideologically based violence and homegrown terrorism in the United States should not violate the constitutional rights, civil rights, or civil liberties of United States citizens and lawful permanent residents. Oh, boy. And certain governments, including United States, Canada, United Kingdom, Canada, Australia, have significantly experience with homegrown terrorism in the United States, can benefit from lessons learned by those nations. I'm going to skip ahead here. There's a lot more. The purposes of the commission are the following. Examine and report upon the facts and causes of violent radicalization, homegrown terrorism, and ideologically based violence in the United States, including United States connections to non-United States persons and networks. How are we going to connect them to Al-Qaeda, huh? Violent radicalization, homegrown terrorism, and ideologically based violence in prison. Individual or lone wolf violent radicalization. So this violent radicalization, now it's just this new term. Now we're going to start hearing it in the news. The violent radicalization of XYZ. Now, next, on MSNBC. Here I am reporting the violent radicalization of the American public. It has begun. It's a phenomenon now. We're all going to establish now by telling you over and over and over and over and over again the violent radicalization of this group, the violent radicalization of that group. Tell me, Ted, how did Joe X become violently radicalized? Well, it appears it happened over the internet. He read these web pages, which told him to become violently radicalized. And like a zombie, he took that information in and became violently radicalized. Thank God for the Violent Radicalization Act of 2007. Now we can throw him in jail for being a thought criminal. Yeah? You think it's a joke? No, that's exactly what you're going to see. If this thing is actually getting traction, I can guarantee you the next words you're going to start hearing on the boob tube are violent radicalization and homegrown terrorism. That's right, Ted. The threat of homegrown terrorism has risen exponentially in the last 2 years. This chart shows us. Incidents of homegrown terrorism have grown by 364% in the last 18 months. This is from the FBI. They wouldn't lie. Well, I'm going to have to leave this for now. There's a whole hell of a lot more, unfortunately. There's a whole hell of a lot more. And I'm going to dig into this and have more for you on this tomorrow. You know, just when you thought that the trashing of the Constitution pretty much has gone as far as they're going to take it, I guess that's a naive point of view, isn't it? You know, to even harbor the hope that they're done stripping us of our constitutional rights. I guess that was kind of silly. Just when you thought, you know, the bottom of the barrel had been reached, look at what we get. Yes, go ahead and look it up. The Violent Radicalization and Homegrown Terrorism Prevention Act of 2007. Oh, boy. There is a little bit of progress on the, speaking of polls, we, you know, talked earlier about how they can never seem to interview Dr. Paul without bringing up the fact that he is in, you know, at near the bottom of the polls. These questionably, polls of questionable methodology. Well, there is some movement here, and I'm just going to run through this because we've only got a few minutes left. A Rasmussen report, which is apparently somewhat of a reputable polling company. I think they polled 1,600, which is somewhat better than the 500 that they poll in these other Gallup polls. Paul versus Clinton and Obama. Paul trails Clinton by only 10 percentage points and Obama by 17, which apparently is somewhat better than just about everybody else in the Republican pack. Let's see. Congressman Ron Paul's electoral strength shows him trailing top Democratic candidates by double digits. Senator Hillary Clinton leads Paul 48% to 38%. Although among male voters, Paul lags Clinton by only 2 points. That's interesting. Well, I guess that would have something to do with the fact that Hillary Clinton is a woman. Let's go ahead to Ron Paul beats Thompson and Huckabee in a New Hampshire poll. In a survey of 1,514 likely voters, likely primary voters, Ron Paul is beating Fred Thompson and Mike Huckabee in New Hampshire. This is a poll conducted by St. Anselm College's New Hampshire Institute of Politics. Shows Hillary Clinton and Mitt Romney in the lead. Romney 32.4%, Giuliani 21.8%, McCain 15.2%, and Ron Paul in fourth place with 7.4%. So there does seem to be a little bit of movement there. Moving up into fourth place in the Republican field. A Newsweek article. It's Independence Day. In New Hampshire, even Ron Paul could have a shot. This is from Newsweek magazine. Basically, the gist of the article is that the Republican field is fractured, and that in the current environment, Ron Paul could get, as they say here, anywhere from 10 to 20%. Which, depending on a variety of factors, could be enough to actually win New Hampshire. Let's see. As George W. Bush's Republican coalition falls apart, its rougher edges become more visible, and Paul's small government isolationist message, here we go with the isolationism again, gets heard. Many New Hampshireites see the state's live free or die motto as an article of faith, and they blame mushrooming federal deficits as much on the GOP as on Democrats. Independents are so mad about spending that they can't see straight, says Jennifer Donahue of St. Anselm College in Manchester. These voters loathe the war in Iraq, too. They are as anti-war as anyone here, maybe more so. Anyway, the conclusion is that Ron Paul has a shot in New Hampshire. California poll, Giuliani is slipping. Rudy Giuliani still leads all Republican presidential candidates in California, but his support in the nation's most populous state has dropped sharply. The New York City former mayor is now first choice at 25% of GOP voters, a hefty 10% drop. Three Republican candidates are now in a virtual tie for second. Mitt Romney got 13%, Fred Thompson and John McCain 12%. The second-tier candidates combined now have 14%, which is double their percentage in the earlier poll. The conclusion of this article from the San Francisco Chronicle is that the Republican field is less defined and more of an open competition than ever before. Also, an article about Mike Huckabee. Mike Huckabee has been showing increasing strength in the polls. A lot of times we're focused on people like Giuliani and Thompson and Romney. And I think that perhaps if we're going to support Dr. Paul, we might want to become more familiar with Mike Huckabee, because it does seem as though he's a comer in this race. So let's go ahead and become more aware of Mike Huckabee. So we're going to go ahead and wrap the show. Got another show coming up behind this one right now. And we'll be back with more for you tomorrow. Now, remember, tomorrow, if everything works out, and I expect it should, we're going to go ahead and have the show broadcast for you on the webpage so that it will be a live TV news report for you. And I will be looking forward to bringing you that tomorrow. And remember, the website is www.ronpaulfreedommessage.com. Hope you've enjoyed the show. Let me leave you with a little bit of a piece of music. And the Freedom Message Train by Scott Mitchell. Tim Daniel and Larry Seeger.
The time to stay silent.